Welcome to Talking Paper, I'm Christian Needon. For this episode, I sat down with veteran screen actor, director, and writer Hampton Fancher at his home in Brooklyn, New York. 2017 is a big year for Fancher, first as the subject of a documentary film about his life and career titled Escapes, set for a summer release. Second, as the co-screenwriter of the feature film Blade Runner 2049, which debuts in October. The film is a follow-up to 1982's massively influential science fiction classic, Blade Runner, directed by Ridley Scott. A film production that Fancher set in motion when he secured the rights to the source novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, from author Philip K. Dick. He then served as screenwriter, before giving way to David Peoples, but maintained an executive producer credit on the film. For this year's follow-up, actors Harrison Ford and Ryan Gosling utilized a screenplay written by Fancher and Michael Green. This interview was my second with Fancher, some 6 years after speaking with him for my film site, Camera in the Sun, about Blade Runner's production, his directing the film The Minus Man, his acting career in television westerns during the 1950s and 60s, growing up a mixed-race child in 1940s East Los Angeles, and his long love affair with flamenco dancing, which took him all the way to Spain as a teenager. During this interview, we discussed Fancher's love of writing, some of his favorite authors, and how their work affected him. He then read some of his own poetry and short stories, including from his 2012 book of short works titled The Shape of the Final Dog, published by Penguin Group imprint Blue Rider Press. I began by asking Fancher the first time he published something on paper.
I had a very scant career, as it were, that way. I think I was only offered one thing in my life, in fact. It was a New York Times piece on man's dress for the Sunday magazine, I think it was, years ago. And it was somebody who was connected to them, nobody official from their offices. And she said, "Do you want to do a piece?" And I said, "Yeah." And about what? And she said, "Clothes." And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to do the idea of business clothing in modern times, like 19th century, how that happened, and write a piece on that." She said, "That's great." So I did it. And I wrote a piece, stole some stuff from John Berger, and had a good time with it. And she loved it, and they loved it, and I chickened out, and I wouldn't let them publish it. I don't know why. I think it's the Berger equation. Because I took some ideas from him, and I transmuted them, I hope. Anyway, that's the only time, I think. And then I published something in a magazine recently, and that's about it, you know, except for the book.
I do want to talk to you about that book, but let's just stick with fashion for a second, because you are a guy who's both acted on screen, directed on screen, where image, costumes can be important. What is it about men's fashion that really inspired you?
I've never hankered after anything, like, let's say, conventional. I cannot have anything in my pockets. I can't wear a belt. I don't wear underwear. I don't wear ties. I mean, I have a tie, but it's rare that I wear it. And I don't like to be restricted physically, you know? And my parents are the same. My sister, too, yeah. And I've always gone my own way, fashion-wise. I don't dress the norm, I don't think. And I never did. And I look back on myself, and it embarrasses me. I mean, the shit that I've worn. It's been kind of absurd, you know, and I can't believe I did it. You know, I was wearing that. You know, I overdressed. Since childhood, I've had ideas about how I wanted to dress. You know, romantic ideas of, you know, fantastical things. I thought I was in another world, you know, and the clothes had something to do with it. So I dressed oddly, I think. From about 17 to about 20, I thought I was Raskolnikov. I mean, I dressed like a Russian tramp, like a bum, you know. Torn clothes. I dressed for well. I remember with sailor pants that were like skin tight, and an old suede jacket that I'd found in an alley, you know. And I went through periods of stupidity. I mean, I can't believe it that I did that.
I'd assume that skin tight stuff would be drawn from your early experience with dance.
Absolutely, it was from bullfighting. Yeah, and that was the concept of it for me. But it was always like I was living in some other, you know, fantasy world in terms of clothes. And I think everybody does that. We all dress to, you know, good hair day, bad hair day, all that shit. This feels bad. I'll change clothes 4 times sometimes just because I don't like the way it feels. And then the next day, the thing I hated, I like. And I don't have many clothes. And I have some interesting clothes, I guess. I have like a Miyake suit, you know, from way back I still wear. And yeah, it's important for me what I wear, I guess.
When you were in television westerns, was there a handbook for you guys who are actors saying, here's what you need for your wardrobe as you book one job to the next?
Oh, no. There was nothing like that. I mean, there were clothes, of course. There was a huge warehouse on Melrose, I think it was. It was called Western Costumes near Paramount. You'd go in there to get fitted. And they'd have the dresser from, you know, the costume guy from the show meet you there. And he would have ideas. And the guy who he was dealing with at the company would have ideas. And you'd have ideas. And you'd say, no. Or you'd say, yes. Or you'd say, what about? And you'd change your hat or, you know, whatever it was. Yeah, there was always choices. But there was no handbook. There should be. I mean, it would be a funny handbook. For other purposes, probably.
Last time we spoke, you were, I believe at the time, either working on or editing a book of short stories, which eventually was published.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that book?
Well, that book, I think there's 12 or 13 stories in it. It's called Shape of the Final Dog, which is the title story, which was the last one that I wrote.
Do you remember what inspired you to say, you know, I'm going to write a book of short stories?
It was Penguin Publishing Company that asked me if I'd like to do that. And it seemed like a great opportunity, a frightening one. You know, it was because I had a really good editor, and she helped me struggle through that process. But it was because of an actor, that's what it was, some famous actor who had run into her at a cocktail party, this editor. And then when he found out what she did, he just happened to mention that he knows a guy who is really a great but unsung writer who would be such a discovery if you could discover him, you know, something like that. He said he pimped me in some way. And then she called and said she wanted to talk. And I talked to her, met her for dinner, and it went from there because I was backing away from it. I can't do this. But she said, you must have something. I said, yeah, I'm always writing, you know. And I told her an idea, and she said, I love that. You know, could you send me that? You know, those pages, those few pages, write them up. And I did. And then I went in, and we signed a contract.
You've been writing for the screen for a long time before that. What was different about the process of short stories versus
writing? I never thought
there
was a difference. No. I mean, screenwriting is restrictive, much more. I mean, I was glad to do the short stories because screenwriting is a very confining mode of writing. It's in a little particular channel, and it's arduous. I mean, all the things that you want to do, you can't do because they have to be here and now, and you're not writing, you know, prose don't make such a difference. And style, prose, etc., make a huge difference in other kinds of writing. And that's one of the reasons took so long for me to write a screenplay, because it did make a difference to me. And my screenplays were always, I had some kind of conceit about the way I put words on the page. And I wanted them to be distinctive and beautiful or strange or whatever I wanted. But I labored at that. And it wasn't a good idea to do that because it took me forever to write a screenplay. And that's why they called me Happen Faster instead of Hampton Fancher, I guess. And it hurt. I mean, I could have probably had a much more successful career if I'd have been writing quicker, as they do. I mean, screenplays are all about, hey, it's just a diagram, get it down and let's shoot it. But I wanted, to, you know, every line to be Joycean or something, you know. And I thought in the beginning it helped me, actually, because it stood out. You know, I thought that I was like an A-list writer. And then one time, and they do have books of lists in the studios, and I met a person who was like assistant to the president of Paramount at a certain point, and I said, is there really a list? Is it like a book? She said, yep. And I said, am I in it? She said, sure, everybody's in it. I said, well, can I see it? She said, I'll sneak your page out and let you see it. And it was kind of disappointing. I thought, you know, I was like going to be this like hot, I mean, this is when I was hot, too. This is like in the middle 80s, you know, people wanted me. I was always, you know, I did a lot of wheeling and dealing. And I was writing and making money. And I think I was on the C list because it said, I mean, next to my name, it said, as a derogatory thing to say, it said artistic. in quotes, like, oh, this guy thinks he's something, and he writes very beautifully, but it's like, forget it, you know, it takes too long. Mm. I mean, it makes no sense for them.
Let's talk about two of the screenplays for two films that you directed as well, The Mighty Quinn and The Minus Man, both based on books. Did you feel inclined to stay close to the source material, or did you bring more of your own to the adaptation?
I mean, a book is not a movie, so it's very hard. I've done a lot of adaptations, and The Mighty Quinn, the name of that that book was Finding Mauby, and that book was so bad that I read 3 pages of it and put it down and didn't read anymore. So I don't have no idea what the, except that the one of the producers, when they asked me to do it, said, and it was a deal I couldn't refuse because they said, I didn't want to do it. And because I'd read those 3 pages, I said, I can't do this. I don't want to do it. So then they said, we have to do it. And if you do it, and you do it however you want to do it, we'll do another film that you want to do. And I had a film I wanted to do that I was making up. It was an original. And so I said, okay, let's do that. And I wrote my screenplay first for the thing I wanted to direct, actually. Then after I finished, then I was obligated to write The Mighty Quinn. It wasn't called The Mighty Quinn then, but I was obligated to write that. And so then I said, I can't do that book, whatever the fuck it is, but I can go through the Caribbean and I'll come up with shit, you know, so send me. And they did, because they liked the other thing I'd done for myself. So I went through I went to various islands and that happened. And it was one of the quicker screenplays I ever did. It took 3 months only to write. But that's often the case. With The Minus Man, it wasn't. I love that book, and that's why I wanted to do it. And it was a lot more complex and a lot more background material in the book and everything. And so I squeezed it dry, kind of. And it was like a watermelon, and I made a lemon out of it. And I was very close to the author. I kept sending him things. What do you think? Is it okay? Because I used more of that than I did with anything. Like, for instance, the first Blade Runner, you know, was very much the book in the first 3 drafts. And then by the time Ridley came in on it, it was almost, in fact, all that was left of Blade Runner was the Voight-Kampff test and maybe 2 characters. But in The Minus Man, I used probably 30% of the book. And the rest is, you know, fabricated.
You mentioned about as the various drafts of Blade Runner came along. When we talked last time, you mentioned that you were influenced for the environmental aspects of the film by the Monkey Wrench Gang. When you read it, what was the impact of that book on you and your friends?
Well, I mean, I love Edward Abbey. And that book is a polemical book. It's not a great book. I mean, I think his essays are great, you know. And he's writing about other things, about himself, whatever. But as a novel, it's got a point to prove. And it's proving it all the time to the detriment of believability, you know. And it's got some great characters. I mean, Hayduk, the rebel, the main rebel in that thing, a rebel to the rebels, is Doug Peacock, a real person who, you know, he modeled him after. Who I didn't meet, but I've talked to him on the phone and we've exchanged a couple of things. Well, he's a hero of mine, Doug Peacock, and an interesting writer. You know, it lit fires ecologically. I mean, in terms of, it just made one more aware of how terrible things were getting, and that was part of the impetus to do the original Blade Runner. In fact, that was the impetus. That was, where have all the animals gone? What's happening to the air and the water? But this planet, we fucked it. And Edward Abbey was the scribe of that. You know, he was the Boswell of our decline, kind of. I mean, in terms of ecology.
And he also very famously lived essentially off the grid, out in the wilds, I believe, of Utah. That was where he lived for a while.
I think there's a lot of contradictions in that guy. The guy who really lived off the grid, who we modeled Hayduk after, was Doug Peacock. When I found out that Hayduk was a real person, in fact, the real person was more extreme than the character in the book. You know, another favorite book of mine is Michael Hare's Dispatches. Mm-hmm. And so when I found out that there was a Hayduk, that the guy's name was Doug Peacock, and that he'd really done, all the, you know, he was a medic and a lerp kind of in Nam, I became really fascinated. I think it was after Abby died, and I found out that Doug Peacock had stolen his body and taken it up on top of a mountain and cremated it, because that's what Abby wanted. And Abby made him promise to do that if he died. And a couple other people were involved in that, because they had to steal it from a mortuary. And they did it. And I just loved this Doug Peacock, you know. And I don't remember who it was. It was had something to do with, you know, Fear and Loathing. And he died.
Hunter,
by this.
Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, Hunter. And Hunter, I think, I don't remember who it was, but somebody connected to Hunter put me in touch with Peacock. Oh, I know what it was. I don't remember who that was, but I remember that when I found out that this person knew Peacock, I said, oh my God, is there any way, he's living in Montana, and is there any way I could, because I was thinking I wanted to do something with him, or I just wanted to drink with him or something, you know? So I said, can you put that together somehow? I was embarrassed. I never do that. I don't want to call somebody. But they did it, and it turned out he knew who I was. So he was like, through this person, whoever that was, said, he wants to talk to you. So, you know, I think it has something to do with Blade Runner.
Yeah.
He must have, you know. But he knew when I talked to him on the phone, and he was, you know, I expected a more, and I could see that he is. He's a tough motherfucker, and he's curmudgeonly, and, you know, he doesn't suffer fools and all that. But he was open and generous and, you know, come to Montana unless, you know, he knows wine. And he has some Petrus or something he talked about that he'd been saving. He said we could open it. You know, I was like, and I've not done anything about it. That was years ago. I mean, 5-6 years ago. And I still wake up like in a, why don't I, you know, but I'm embarrassed. And he sent me a film that they'd made of him, a little documentary on, what do you call that, VHS or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I didn't send it back to him. I still have it. And I'm frozen. I'm Peacock frozen.
If you hear this, Mr. Peacock.
Yeah, if you hear this, Peacock, I love you. This is Hampton Fancher. And I'm going to get it to you.
Let's just stick with that one last time. Is there a favorite writer of yours? And it can be a writer, it can be an artist, who you have met that you've had the opportunity to do because of the career path that you took.
Yeah.
Is there a favorite or a couple of favorites?
William Burroughs. I mean, I met him because of the career I took, you know, took me or whatever.
What point did you meet him? It was in the 90s when
he was
on the
In 75 when I was looking for something to do. I mean, I had 10, it's the only time I'd ever have 10 grand in my life, I figured. Someone gave it to me. And they said, do something, you know, in terms of like option a property or something. And so I decided to option 3 property. I was totally naive. I didn't understand how to do that. I didn't know how much money it took, but I thought $10,000 was like $10 million. I thought I was Donald Trump. You know, it's like, I own the world. I'll do all this now. I wouldn't want to write and direct these things. I just thought they were good ideas commercially because I love these guys. I thought, okay, which was a dumb idea, especially in 75, William Burroughs. You know, no one even knew who William Burroughs was in that world of Hollywood, you know. But that's what I thought. And the other one was Charles Bukowski. And Bukowski, nobody knew who that was, in 75 especially. And the other one was Philip K. Dick. So I tried to get those guys involved, and I thought they could write a screenplay for themselves and I would produce it. I didn't mean literally produce it, but line produce it. But I'd see that it was done, and I'd reap the financial rewards from it, which would allow me to do the stuff that nobody would do. But this shit that I was trying to do that, nobody would do. It was impossible, and none of it happened, except I met all these guys and had a good time. I mean, Burroughs and Dick and Bukowski.
Let's stick with Burroughs for a second. Is there a favorite work of his that you enjoy?
Yeah, I like most of it. I think it's had a big influence on me, everything I've read of his. I guess I've read everything. Of course, Naked Lunch. Wild Boys is a big one for me. There's characters in that that I don't know if they inform me so much as they encourage me, because I think I have those same characters in my head. I just loved him. I loved his writing. It's been an influence on me. A liminal influence, too. I mean, I think it's more of an influence than I know. I don't know that it's, I mean, it's good. I mean, there's no fruition to it except in my own soul. You know, it's not like, you know, I made any headway or money way or anything because of it. I don't think.
I'm glad you mentioned Bukowski, because I did want to ask you about your affinity for poetry. Let's start with Charles Bukowski. What is it about his style that appeals to you?
Bukowski in poetry is the same thing with the short stories, or his so-called novels, but the short stories do it, and the poetry usually does it, but the short stories always do it. He'll be talking about jacking off in a garage or whatever, you know, and eating a can of tuna, and, you know, whatever the little, the four or five pager is, and then the last line, he will slice your head off with a philosophical triumph that you didn't expect from nowhere, and neither did he, I don't think, you know, but he always does it. It's just like, whoa, he just wraps it. I mean, I enjoyed reading every line, but then at the end, he's got a way of tying a cosmological, ontological bow on that box that you can tell he didn't expect as well. I mean, it's subtle, you know, I'm exaggerating maybe, exaggerating the subtlety. And so that's one thing, but it's just, it's the persona, you know, it's the voice. And, you know, there's a character that comes through beside whatever characters he's writing about, which is always him. I haven't read him in years, but I loved him. And I don't think he's a major writer. I don't think he's an influence on other writers necessarily, like whereas Burroughs, I think, is.
Tell me about your engagement with poetry. Is this something that's been a lifelong thing? Did you come to it later in life?
No, it's lifelong. I mean, I was not a literary kid. I didn't read for a long time. I was, you know, I was Johnny come lately to reading, and I have no scholastic experience. And so I only ran into two things as a child, and I didn't know what they were until much later. And then I felt like a little blessed in an opportunistic way that there was a book that my parents had that had tissue thin paper, and it was an old book. And I liked the pages, and I didn't have any restrictions as a kid. I could fuck around with stuff. As I broke something, no one said, "Oh, what have you done?" You know, it was pretty freewheeling in the house. And I used to draw with crayons, you know, like Japanese Zeros being shot down by American Mustang, you know, planes or whatever. You know, bad 7-year-old stuff. I loved that book to do that in. But there was a little poem. It was a book of poetry. It turned out to be the Oxford Book of English Verse, a 1905. Publication of it that my father had or something. So I knew that book, and there was this poem, little tiny poem that I used to, and I was dyslexic, I had a hard time reading, you know, but this little paragraph, I used to read it, and I liked it, and it was about a little black boy, and something about that, I didn't know, I only knew one black kid in grammar school, and that guy, I guess it got my attention, so I used to like reading that poem. And then when I kind of tried to be a poet myself as a teenager, I realized I came across that poem somewhere, and it was Blake. It was William Blake. And I thought, fuck, I was in good company right off the bat, you know. It touched me and probably geared up my life to go in a certain direction, I think. And then I started thinking of myself as a poet in my you know, I didn't go to school and all that stuff. I was, you know, hanging around the world at 15, 16, 17. And around 17, around 16, I met a poet. And he could wake for the sun who scattered into flight the stars before him from the field of night, drive night along with him. And what's that? And he went on and on and on and on in this bar, cafe, and the donut shop. And I just went crazy for that. And I had to memorize it. It was the fucking Rubaiyat. You know, he'd memorized the entire Rubaiyat, then I did. You know, that was it. I had that. Then it was, you know, whoever I started reading and trying to write. I thought I was a poet. I still think that. I still think of myself as a, you know, an aspiring poet or a workaday trying to write poetry poet. And I do, you know, all the time.
In your early life, when you first came upon this, do you think that also balanced out with the physicality of your artistic expression of dance, which doesn't have words, where now this satisfied your intellectual artistic
side? Yeah, it seems like it, yeah. I mean, it was either I was dancing or stealing cars or reading poetry, which sounds rather interesting, but I, you know, I'm just an idiot who was doing all these things.
Were you aware of any of Chicano poets or writers?
No, nothing. Not until I had no idea, not until La Costa, you know, not until Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, yeah. You know, the Brown Buffalo, you know, whatever his, that name is. Pachuco came out, you know, that was then I began to see more of that. But I was aware of them politically, but not literarily until I was in my 30s or so. Mm.
And did you ever get the chance, you know, when we were doing our sound test today, you recited Shakespeare to me, some Richard III.
Oh, yeah. That guy that I met when I was 15 or 14 or whatever it was, he turned me on to that. He was doing Richard all the time. And then I started reading Shakespeare.
That's the great thing, because at the same time, at least in your acting career, when you're doing these Westerns and other roles that you have, did you ever get a chance to do stage roles or anything classically theatrical at all?
No, I never did any. I did, you know, plays. The longest play was Cuckoo's Nest in L.A. in the opening of Cuckoo's Nest in 65 or 66. But I never did anything classical. I never directed anything classical.
Which begs the other question, too. The Ken Kesey's writing is almost like defiantly non-classical in terms of the way it tells its story, because it's from this guy's point of view. It's from Chief's
sure.
point of view. What was it like reciting those lines where now this non-conformist Ken Kesey's work is being put into this classic stage format, and then you're now in his protagonist?
I never thought about it. You know, I never read the book when I did the play.
Really?
I think I was ignorant of Cuckoo's Nest when I did the play in 65, 64. In fact, I just ran into a guy who works at the liquor store, who somehow that came up. He's a Frisco guy, and I forgot that play was, before it went to New York, it was being done, the play, in San Francisco. Ran for a long time. And we who were doing, I mean, you know, it was after New York that we did it in L.A. And I remember then being aware that it had been done in Frisco before. The play,
yeah. Was it Kirk Douglas who had originated the role?
Yeah, he played it in New York, and then that's his son got a hold of it and did the, you know, produced the film with Jack and all that, which was like more perfect than Kesey could imagine. I imagine. I mean, he must have said that to people.
Yeah. The final thing on these adaptations are, you mentioned before that, for instance, the book that The Minus Man was based on, you loved that book,
yeah.
And it was something that. That drove you to adapt it the way you did. I want to ask you about turning that love back to subject matter for this book of short stories, because I do want to hear more about that book. Do you find yourself, at least in that context, writing about things that you loved or that you wanted to highlight in short story form that had been kind of subconsciously been saving up for years? You're like, now is my opportunity to write about this. Or was it, now you've got to come up with a certain quota of stories to make. Did you feel a push-pull of wanting to highlight things that you loved versus trying to make a page count?
I mean, of course, the page count idea must be there. I mean, because one is terrified.
Yeah.
At least I am. I was like, I don't, not now, but I remember like, oh my God, how can this ever happen? How can I do it? What can I do? I'm shit. You know, there's like, I have all these scribblings. But somehow it happens, and I guess it happens because of the page count, but that's not what it is really, because what it really is it's like a poem. I mean, you started to ask me a question a while back that we never covered about, is there a difference between stealing cars and writing poetry and dancing and you know, acting in movies or whatever.
Yeah.
And it sounds kind of facile or cute or something to say what I'm going to say, but there is no difference, I don't think. I mean, sure, there is structurally, formally, whatever. But it's the same key, it's the same ignition that turns the engine on, and that which road you drive down, you know, any of those roads, but it's the same car.
Yeah.
And that's, I really think that, because I've had serious engagement as a dancer, or serious engagement in these other areas we're talking about, so to say disciplines, and it's really the same me. I don't mean to be metaphysical. It's the same dream. It's the same vanity. It's the same hope. It's the same history. One's history is coming out somehow. And it's the same expressiveness. It's the same painting. Mm. Or it's the same brush. Not the same painting. And It's dreaming, really. It's a good thing for a lazy guy to do. Playing, having fun while you're terrified. And the vanity part of it is, is the result. Otherwise, like, ooh, I like that. That, well, Jesus Christ. And I look back on things if I run across something or someone says something to me, you know, a line from Blade Runner or whatever. And I say, fuck me. I don't have any recollection of writing that. And it seems too good for me. You know what I mean? I don't know how I could. I didn't say that, you know, or whatever. But that's what it's like.
I'd love to hear you read some of your own work. Can you tell me about some of the things you're going to be reading for me?
Someone asked me to send them a short that I wrote, and I have it here on the screen. I have no idea what it is. I just found it before you came. A guy in England said, I heard you wrote a couple shorts. And I thought, fuck, I have at least a couple, and I don't write in the usual way. What I thought we'd do is I'll look into my poetry file and just pick out a poem.
Sure.
But maybe we ought to try this for a second since it's here. The serendipity of
it. Let's give it a shot.
The F train. Just tell me if there's a 9 car in New York. I know at York Street there's an F car. A 9 car would be the no car in German. And if there's no 9 car in New York, then probably there's no 8. And what about 10? He was working on this, thinking about it, a handsome young Arab, maybe not, probably Berber, maybe Algerian, a bit gay, a little confused, not just because he's on the F train trying to get to Manhattan, but he got on the train on the wrong side of the track. He was thinking about English, and just before this, before he came to New York, he'd been living in Berlin, and now he was on the F train. Got on the wrong side because he was thinking about the word 9, which in German means no, and he was wondering if there might be a no train. Certainly, he wasn't on the yes train. He was on the F train going in the wrong direction, and there were only 2 other people in the car. He was standing by the door at the end of the car so he could get off at the next stop, and there was a proper-looking middle-aged black lady sitting across from him. She was facing forward, so he was looking at her profile. But he had the feeling she knew he was looking at her, so he looked away. Rush hour was over, but still there should have been more people in the car. He looked down the length of it. It was almost empty except for one other passenger who was sitting just on the other side of the middle door. The guy looked like he was in his late 20s, in black pants, in black shoes, and very white, with thinning blondish hair that probably in a year looked like it would be no hair at all. He was wearing a white shirt and a tie, and instead of a belt, he had a string around his waist with little tassels on it, maybe not a Hasid, but for sure Orthodox, and very nervous. Something was wrong about this guy. And the Algerian couldn't stop looking at him. This guy looked like he was going to do something, like he was going to flip. Didn't seem to be able to keep his big feet still. And he kept looking around, but wasn't really looking at anything particular. The Algerian looked at the black lady to see what she thought. And he saw that she was looking at the Jewish guy too. And then she looked at him. And he knew, they both knew the same thing about this crazy Jewish guy. When he looked back at the guy was standing now. The train stopped for the next station, but the guy didn't get out. Neither did the black lady. Neither did the Algerian, who forgot to get out because he was looking at the Jewish guy. Nobody knew got out. And when the train started, the Jewish guy sat down, and the Algerian looked away in the other direction so he didn't have to look anymore, then realized he forgot to get off the train. And all he could do now was go in the wrong direction until the train stopped again, and he could go upstairs and get some air. He didn't want to be underground anymore. He looked at the floor a while, then up at the black lady. She looked terrified. The Jew was on his feet again, standing in the middle of the car, trying to keep his balance, with this nasty look on his face, and he was staring at the black lady, pointing a gun at her. It was small and silver, a 6-shooter, that looked cheap, almost like a toy, except it wasn't. It was real, and the Algerian, without fear, the fear would come later, stepped between the Jew and the black lady. Now the pistol was pointed at him. Then the Algerian, very calm, very easy, stepped closer to the Jew and put his hand out for the pistol, and the Jew put the pistol in his hand, and that was that. Gunless now, the Jew sat down. It starts again, the Algerian at the end of the car thinking about Berlin, about the German word nine, and about the English number nine. And he was on the F train going in the wrong direction. And then he looked at the black lady who was facing forward, then at the young jittery Jewish man who was older than him, halfway down the car, nervously looking around, moving his feet in his big black shoes. A man who resented the world because he didn't have the courage to go to a skin shop and pay for a hand job, is what the Algerian thought, before he realized he was going in the wrong direction and the train stopped. And the Jew, who already sat down, was on his feet again, and the train started, and the Jew sat down again, and the Algerian was looking at the black lady again, and she was terrified, and there was the pistol pointed at both of them now, and the Algerian hit the floor and screamed, covered his head, and begged the Jew not to shoot him, and he didn't care what happened to the black lady or what she thought. Then it started over again, all the same stuff, except there was no pistol this time, and when the train stopped, only the black lady stayed. And just the Jew and the Algerian got off. The Algerian was aware of the Jew behind him when he went up the stairs to the street, and it scared him. He wasn't sure if the Jew had the pistol on him or not. It was already dark, and it had started to rain, and there was lots of traffic on the street, and the Algerian wanted to cross it and get away from the Jew, who was standing right behind him, he thought. But he was confused and wasn't really sure where the Jew was, so he looked over his shoulder to check, but at the same time stepped off the curb into the street without looking. The Jew grabbed him by the arm and yanked him back so the bus that roared by didn't kill him.
It's a hell of a New York piece for a man with an L.A. soul. I like it.
I was thinking of doing a short of that, you know, but it's a Borgesian kind of thing. I mean, this, like, happening over and over again is a different conclusion. Fine. Poem, okay. More often, our brief definitions, unacknowledged quotations addressed to unpresent animals, objects, inclusive dictions, the hyperbole and mention of rhymes, stubbornly by the nose of intrusion to ornamentations. The answers included are why and way off the rails to the glittering mines at the end of the line.
Nice.
Gray doves in gray sky, jungle green leaves invigorate the window. The rain and the waiting, a safe place never seen except in a magazine. Ditched where everything remains. No packing boxes, no good will come of that. Not falling snow. Horizontal makes the wind show where it goes. Bought new shoes, wet, and the cold up to the corner today. For today and tomorrow's bottle, call it White Dragon. Mm. Shakespeare, born in Latin, dies in English. Green acorns and other adulterants mixed in the fall. Wait to sleep, sleeps to wake. One of us away on a visit, day after tomorrow, pretending it was true. The dirt and the termless embrace. Tyrannical earth, smoky lilacs, lobsters, hummingbirds do not get old. A kingdom of nails. The softies come and go. The lobsters know. Mm. Himmler staring at the puppies in a pet shop window. A god above his thin-lipped lisp, thin hair dyed shoe polish black. Military pat, electrified, carpet rides we had. Send grass, I want to die in Hawaii. Children of the Queen's revels, remember we forgot every cavity a shining truth that aches with contradiction. A noteworthy guest to the host of himself. The jaws of consciousness, watch pocket in giant pants, a poor boy parade, bearded bitches whacking their pots and pans, exposing a cardboard pecker. Apothecaries, shelves, purple nutballs, clouded jars, you cut it big. Untrue illusion is false, if false illusion is true. The mind sled, the words slide, gasping in the blue of your afternoon, reading Boat Race Harry. Throw off the glasses and pull off his pants, as long as it doesn't interfere with the works. A red ant incinerated in a watermelon. The good to be known beyond our own. I took no decision. what good is it to be given beyond getting? Ask the dog. Just wrote a poem about a dog the other day in Spanish.
Do you write poetry every day? Or do you try to, every week?
Every day, yeah, a little bit here and there, you know. I mean, just, you know, I don't know if it qualifies as poetry, but yeah, something happens every day, seems like. Lo que el perro no sabe es para siempre. ¿Quién es el mejor amigo del perro? What the dog doesn't know is forever. And who is dog's best friend? His gravestone read, ask the dog.
Yeah.
Sandy fire pit, witch dancing, pussy moths in the desert will ever wash the rage from your heart that my little mistake I made on your appliance ignited. Burning and yum, ditto fucking itself. Odorophobia and fear of fears, growing antlers in the dark. A German police dog snatched Kaiser rolls, the early bird special, growling that God is wet panties in the mind of a gun. Now, that sounds to me a little Bukowski-ish. In the cool, quiet cocklight of the green-bladed corn, blood-flecked vomit of divine rights appoint the squeamish brats of heroes born. Smell the damp wool of their powdered armpits, emblemata of phallocracy, trimmings to clothes, badges to hats, faded black flourishes on twice-folded gifts. If Shakespeare were a streetcar named Desire, his plays would be Stanley, his sonnets Mitch. But what satisfaction gets a man for keeping a close eye on his cactus? Neither is he paid nor respected. Then ask yourselves this, why would he persist? Yet he hangs in there because he needs to observe, and if he can, even assist in the growth of green silence in anticipation of navigational surprises that he fancies the cactus sometimes realizes as perception conforming to objects or objects conforming to sound and light in neither eye nor ear in the inverted curves of Copernican crockery, collapsing in funnels of physics. Or rather you gaze at virgin and child in their pretty blue smocks, smelling of urine and shit, porcelain swords and the bulls of religion. A china shop clown with a lute should have sung it for old Father Lloyd and his altar boy Tim. It's been a murder 'em all sort of story, but now the sun has gone down and the crows are asleep, all hunched on their limbs. It stops without saying and starts with a bell.
Very well done.
Thank you.
I think we'll leave on the poetry there. It was fantastic. Thank you for reading such a great selection.
Thank you for asking me.
Would it be possible to read maybe just a paragraph of your book of short stories?
The name tag on her tunic read Olympia. Three desolate blocks in Red Hook was her route. She pushed her cart up the empty sidewalk and stopped in front of a four-story tenement across the street from Abe's warehouse. Before he came to the window to watch her, Abe was in the bathroom checking his neck. He suffered from a swelling of the lymph nodes, something akin to scrofula, the nurse at the clinic said. It wasn't as bad as it looked, didn't hurt much, but the blistering was unattractive, and he didn't like being in the window when there was a flare-up. Not that the mail lady would notice. She was across the street sorting the mail. So far, Abe has never exchanged a word with her, never had the occasion to. But the kid across the street did. He was sure of that. Abe did his talking at the window, saying what he would say if he ever got the chance. I'm grander than you, more glorious, and if I decide you're worth it, long-legged male lady, I'll paint you with fire. You'll never be able to spend the wealth of my love, not in a dozen years, a dozen lifetimes. By the way, I stole that dialogue right there from Jonathan Lethem, took it right out of his of something he'd written, and called him and said, can I use that, those lines? He said, go ahead. He'd written that wonderful essay, The Ecstasy of Influence. Abe was an artist, a small, beaky man, lean and fervent, at least at a distance. He even wrote her a letter once that he never sent, but couldn't find. Everybody on the block hopes you're smart enough to take advantage of me as soon as possible. I'm taller than you. He was not taller than her. Olympia was almost 6 feet. Abe was not quite 5'6". and he didn't know anybody on the block, made it his business not to. He watched her go up the stairs into the tenement where the kid lived. What happens to the small apartment of a seldom-seen father and an untidy kid was the shape this one was in. The kid was sprawled on the couch, one foot cocked on the cushion, the other on the floor. He was puggish, quick-eyed, and 10. Bottle of beer in one hand, letter in the other. What he was reading was making him wince. You have been selected by a higher being? You're the kind of woman who needs to have it put to her forcefully? Jeez, give me a break. I'll take you, roll over on your back, show me your soft parts. To one such as you, my science is magic. You wish. I'll tickle and lap your succulent vitals. The effect of my desire will ripple the moonlight on the pond of your flesh. The kid stuffed the letter back in the envelope, finished his beer, and got to his feet. Abe was looking for a needle to sew a button on his pants when he was jolted by the knock. He froze. He waited. Whoever it was knocked again. There was nothing to do but go to the door. Abe did, opened it, and there was the kid holding up the letter. Abe didn't know what to do. The kid said, "Take it." "What is it?" "A letter." "So? You send it?" "To who?" "Me. It was in my mailbox." Abe took the letter, and as soon as he did, he realized he forgot to put on his pants. "Read it." Abe extracted it from the envelope, pretended to read a couple of lines. "Where'd you get this nonsense?" "I told you, in my mailbox." "The mail lady must have made a mistake. There's no stamp on the envelope. Like I said, she made a mistake." "Maybe, maybe not." There were people on the block who knew what Abe did, but nobody the kid knew had ever been inside the warehouse. Abe could see the kid was curious and stepped aside to give him a look. He'd watched the kid for more than a year, knew some things about his life, had gone through his trash. The kid had watched Abe as well, seen him have an argument with a tramp once about an umbrella that Abe said was his. The kid slipped into the warehouse. Except for the cot and a trestle table bearing the tubes, cans, and brushes, and all the wild slop of the painter's trade, the place was almost empty. But there were lots of paintings. Some leaned against the walls, some were hung, all of them portraits except for one. A dirigible grounded on a barren field. The kid fixed on it. Abe watched him move up for a closer look. "You drink with a mail lady? I see her go into your building. I don't see her come out." "What is this, a blimp?" "Yeah." "What color of eyes she got?" "Well, how would I know?" "Brown, right?" "Hazel." "Which is about the same thing. There's green and brown when it's hazel. You know your colors, kid. How come you don't go to school?" "I go. I just don't go out of my way to do it." Abe didn't know any kids. Never had one look at his paintings. "What are you going to do when you grow up?" "Interview the crab man." "You watch the show?" "Of course." "You think it's going to run till you grow up?" "Doesn't have to. Crabman's about to retire." "You drink with her, right? I see her go in. I don't see her come out." "Sure you do. You see her come out. I've seen you looking." "You have sex with her?" "I'm 10. "Brush up against her?" "Once." "Her against you or you against her?" Abe could see the kid had no interest in this line of thought, so he got to the point. "I want to paint her." The kid held up a thumb and squinted at the blimp, like an artist appraising a perspective. "I like this blimp." Abe watched him turn away and make for the exit. Not right letting him leave without saying goodbye, but goodbye wasn't right. "You like the crab man more than you like yourself?" "No, I like myself more, but I like myself more because I like the crab man." Then he went right for the door, turned back to Abe, sliced the air with the flat of his hand and left. Abe walked over to the blimp to have a look for himself. "I like myself less than I like this blimp, which is why the blimp makes me feel good about myself. I guess that's about the same thing." For dinner, the kid had blah, 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 and it goes on.
That's a good place to leave it. I like it. I think what that carries over again is that it's a theme of these interactions of these characters that you create. And it's tough to ask a writer if there's a theme to their work, but it strikes me that you do have a love of people and of interactions of people. Would you say that's true?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Like you. You know, you talk to people easily. New York is a good place for a guy like me that way. You know what I mean? I talk to people on the subway, whatever. There's funny things that happen, as opposed to talking to the squirrels in Topanga Canyon. You know, that's good too, but they don't respond very well.
Do you think you draw inspiration, though, from these interactions, the fact that you bump up, as to quote a line from there, bumping up against people, rubbing up against people here in the city? Does that still give you that vital inspiration that you look for as a writer?
I don't know about as a writer, just as a person. I mean, I find myself, ever since I moved here, say, I fucking love New York. If I'm not saying I hate New York. And I think that's the experience everybody has, or people who are awake to it.
And I want to leave on this question. We'll make this the last question, because I am curious about it, because I like the title. Tell me about the title of this book.
The title of this book came from, and I had a big fight with the publishers about that. They didn't want to call it that, and I really wanted it. And they had other titles I had and that they liked better. But it's an acid title. You know, I was driving as a passenger with my lawyer, both of us on acid, down in the desert. And I said two things I remember from that moment of, you know, bleak desert, beautiful, Anza Borrego. And I was looking at everything passing, and I said, Father Rubber and his dancing dimes. And we couldn't stop, you know, I mean, it might be funny, I hope, but we laughed, like, couldn't stop, you know, gagging, dying. And half hour went by, still in the desert driving, and then I said, you know, I was just looking at the end of everything. I was thinking it's all going to, it was an Edward Abbey moment, you know. And I said, this is the shape of the final dog. And again, we couldn't stop laughing. So that always stayed in my head, as it has, you know. And then I had this story I wrote that a dog was involved, a dog who wasn't real, a replicant dog. And that was started the new Blade Runner. And they asked me if I would write a Blade Runner story. They didn't. They asked me if I wanted to write one more. There was room for one more story. And so I wrote that story. I mean, I was already thinking about it, and then I wrote it. And I thought that was that was the title of the story, and I thought that's the title of the book. They didn't like that. And I guess they were right, probably, because nobody bought the fucking book. I mean, that's not why. I don't imagine. I hope not. Hope they didn't buy the book because the Penguin didn't do their job. Or maybe the book is no good. But that's where that came from. The shape of the final dog goes back to about 1969 or 70 or 71, around there.
Hmm. I like it. It's very evocative. I think it's evocative.
But in your mind, yes.
Yeah.
You and I, who sit and laugh and talk easily. But I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. I thought it was a good title. I like the cover even, you know, in that ghosty sand, like, you know.
It's a very deliberate font.
Yeah.
For that, which is great. Well, on that note, Hampton Fancher, thank you for being on Talking Paper.
Thank you.
To listen to more Talking Paper interviews like this one, check out our podcasts at audioboom.com/channel/Talking Paper. Finally, an excerpt from Fancher's The Shape of the Final Dog. The book's title short story is also its last, and provides an opportunity for Fancher to publish an excised portion from his original Blade Runner screenplay, known as the soup scene. In this excerpt, Fancher builds tension between a tracker named Card and a steelhead named Sapper. Sapper was long and strong, unhealthy-looking skin, blotchy, shoulders stooped, eyes sunken, knobby cheekbones. He closed the door, then turned to face Card, but not directly. Card's voice was gentle, unsurprised. "Where's your dog, Mr. Morton?" Sapper was shy. It took a few moments to get his words to come. "Outside. Who are you?" "I'm from the CPA, Mr. Morton, the Canadian Potato Association." Pulling himself to attention, Sapper recited the Canadian Potato Association motto, "Within one potato, there are mountains and rivers." Card was impressed. Sapper was either trickier or more evolved than he looked. "That was good. Do you have a name for your dog?" "No." "Shall I tell you why I'm here?" "Yes." "I'm to do a survey on tenant farmers to see if growth ratio and land allotments are keeping pace with each other. Do you understand?" Sapper dimly nodded, then looked at the evaluator, blinking and purring on the table. Then he looked away, to the soup on the stove, boiling low and steady. What's that you're cooking there? It smells pretty good. Sapper went to the burner, checked the pot, then turned to look at Card, his eyes doggish and sad, hopeful maybe. Do you want some? That would be nice, thank you. It took time for him to get the bowl. Card watched him pour soup into it. Carefully, Sapper brought it to the table with a spoon. There was only the one chair. He stepped aside and waited for Card to sit on it. Before I try the soup, Sapper, I want you to sit on the chair. I need to ask you some questions. Will you do that? I already had my dinner. Before I have mine, I need you to sit down. Sapper started to, but hesitated. It was the evaluator that troubled him. Do I have to? You don't have to, but it won't take long. All you have to do is sit down and be very still. Can you do that? Slowly, as if afraid the weight of him might break the chair, Sapper sat down. Duplicants were disadvantaged from beginning to end, but never knew it. Card knew it, and it divided him. It made him tired, but he forced himself to pay attention. Now please put your hand on the table. Sapper lifted his hand. His fingers were short and strong, nails like burnt rubber. His hand trembled above the table. Go ahead, Sapper, it'll be fine. Lay it down on the table. Either Sapper couldn't or wouldn't. He looked up, one eye twitching, a plea in his gravelly voice. I took this test before, I think. Card preferred to keep the questions in order. How did you get here? Did anyone help you? Do you play the piano? But it was too late for that. The pulsing of the evaluator had increased. Card knew what was coming next, and for the sake of his ears, stepped back. Nobody ever sees me! That's not true, Sapper. If it was, I wouldn't be here. Sapper got louder. I work with objects, not people. I drive the tractor. There was no room in the spinner for Sapper, but Card made the offer. It was in the manual. Why don't we just leave and you come back to the city with me? Sapper had turned dark, indignant. Card shrugged as Sapper stumbled to his feet, brought his fist down on the table like a hammer. Card snatched the evaluator off the table as it collapsed, set it on the counter, and turned. He released the safety on his fermium and shot Sapper three times, twice in the chest and once in the groin. Sapper went down so hard he cracked the floor. His stout legs buckled under him, no blood, but he was dead. That's all for this episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.